Repeat the question, please. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Neil Almond.
Hello, everyone. Lovely to be here.
And Wild Bill Bones.
How are we doing?
This week, I've got four unseen questions from teachers who are either at the very start of their career or will be beginning their career in September. But first, Neil, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
So I am reading, it's from the Encyclopedia of the Sciences of Learning, and it's called Variation Theory. And these are literally just two sides of A4. The whole thing is like, I've got the PDF here, it's like 3,643 pages long. But it's just effectively just, as it says, an encyclopedia of the sciences of learning. So everyone just has two sides to write about something that they are clearly expert in. So it's a kind of really nice introduction for all of that. And the reason why this was particularly interesting for me is because there is a delightful article in there by, I'm guessing, Jorin van Merenboa on the variability of practice. The reason why that was interesting to me is that Merenboa has done a lot of work inside the cognitive load theory sort of literature. And this, as far as I can tell, is kind of the first time that someone from that cognitive load literature directly references variation theory. For those of you that listened to the two-parter on the 20 years of cognitive load theory, it was kind of stemmed from kind of reading that paper, you know, where is that point that, you know, cognitive load theory and variation theory, you know, is there a world where these two kind of theories collide? And as I say, this entry in the Encyclopedia of the Sciences of Learning from 2012, I think, is the kind of that first instances where I can kind of see these two worlds colliding. What about you, Lloyd? What are you reading for?
I've been reading, as you say, reading. I'm trying to read, not very successfully. Homo naledi, a new species of the genus Homo from the Naledi Chamber in South Africa, which to be honest, it's not an easy read. But if you're interested in kind of species, you know, development and genus and so on and so forth, I mean, it's pretty fascinating. I know, Neil, you sort of put me onto this, and Kieran and the group, us onto this in terms of the Ancients podcast, wasn't it? That is it. Burgers, the lead archaeologist on the dig, came on to speak, and I listened to the podcast. It was absolutely fascinating, surrounding this new species, the Homo naledi, that they've discovered, which they're dating to around 300,000 years ago. And they there's some pretty bold claims in this paper, and Neil and I have recently discovered archaeology Twitter, which is interesting, because it's very similar to the edgy Twitter. There's right old arguments going on, and people like quote tweeting each other and quote xing each other, whatever it's called now. I refuse to use that terminology. It's mental, like, and essentially what's happened with this paper, it was published by, I want to say, eLife. They're like a publishing, it was peer reviewed, and it's basically all the people who peer reviewed it slammed it and said, no, you can't really publish this. But they published it anyway and said, here's what the people who peer reviewed said about it, but we're going to go ahead and put it out there, but here's the notes that they said. And this has caused quite a lot of anger in the community, in the sort of archaeology community, because it's kind of devalued the the sort of process of peer evaluation. And essentially, these guys have found an amazing site. Like these, they've found bones in a cave system in South Africa, which of this species, and evidence of burial. We're talking now 300,000 years ago, which was long time before anything like that was happening anywhere else documented by any other digs across the world. There's quite a sensationalist sort of documentary about it that's come onto Netflix called, I want to say, Unknown Cave of Bones. I might be wrong there. And again, it's a beautifully filmed documentary, but it's got the archaeology world up in arms about things. I won't spoil it because there's some fascinating takeaways from this. And there's definitely some, there is something there. There's got to be. If you look at the kind of evidence around what they found, there has to be something there. Whether it's the extent of what they've illustrated in this paper and kind of in terms of the development of the genus, I don't know. I think that's where the jury's out still on that. But yeah, so a bit of a curveball one for me, really. It's not the sort of thing I would normally be attempting to read. But yeah, it was quite interesting. Max, what are you reading for?
Nice. Obviously, Neil signposted that podcast 2 episodes ago. That's great that you've taken it one step further and gone for a paper that inspired that episode from them. I mean, I think we need to track archaeology Twitter. But yeah, no, I think absolutely fascinating. And if it's as tough as that sort of evolutionary biology stuff we read a while ago, Lloyd, maybe I'll take it piece by piece. But I really need to start doing some heavy lifting because Neil's doing all of the work. You know, we are group work in action when we're preparing for our red talk because he's reading all these papers and I'm thinking, right, okay, I will get around to this. I've got two sort of work really well together, and maybe three. You've got two by Daisy Christodoulou, just called Multiple Choice Questions. Part two is available on thinkingdeeply.info in the sort of references list. And then there's also Oiling the Hinges by Harry Fletcher Wood. And just anyone who's interested in multiple choice questions and hinge questions, I think they feed each other quite well. And so well worth checking out together, the sort of the set of three. Because I know Daisy went into the research on multiple choice questions as well, around about a similar time. So I've just been sort of trying to look at different themes because I'm obviously mentioned Blake Harvard's hinge question blog from a while back, and that sort of sparked my interest. So when I should be reading about variation theory, I've been actually off in a different direction reading about hinge questions instead. Before we continue, Lloyd, obviously the last time you were on, you were talking about the strength of the Irish sort of World Cup, I don't know, hopes, aspirations. But obviously, we sort of both saw the New Zealand-Australia game at the weekend. And it was very much like the Hamburglar in The Simpsons, where they really should have stopped the game with 20 minutes to go. I don't know, do you still think Ireland have as good a chance? Or have we just made the All Blacks angry?
I mean, the All Blacks are always angry. To be honest, you could just never rule them out. They're always going to be there or thereabouts. Like, they're just such forces. I mean, to put that many points on Australia on their home turf in such a show force is just ridiculous to win the rugby championship. I think it'll be interesting to see how Wales and England fare on Saturday. That will set a lot of kind of markers down. But I'm still confident about Ireland. Like, I genuinely think they're going to be close. I mean, I had a look at the groups as well in the week, and I mean, that poor Scottish group is just, it's hideous. I mean, who's coming out of that? I don't know. And the way the seedings have gone, the two sides of the competition, we've actually fallen in quite a nice side, as of England. We can end up losing some of those big guns really early on, actually. So it'd be an interesting tournament, but I'd still keep my money on Ireland being close to semi/final.
Obviously, Saturday's game, England-Ireland, was supposed to be Johnny Sexton's swan song, wasn't it, at the Aviva? But got himself suspended for having some choice words when he wasn't even playing in a match and got a 3-match suspension. Fantastic work.
He did.
So I can imagine he'll have choice words at halftime this week and miss the whole pool because he's already missing the first game, isn't he? So, yeah, only in Ireland. like I said, this week we have some questions from very new teachers. I thought I'd throw them towards you guys. You can come at it from the position of leader, but also you've been there, you've developed your craft, you feel reasonably comfortable with your craft at this point in your careers. So as with all the unseen questions, it's purely opinion based. And if anyone has any suggestions themselves, you know, throw them in the X repost or repost. I don't know what we're calling them these days. And we can continue the conversation there.
I'll not have it. I think we use the language of Twitter until the end of time, and we don't kneel to this. It's just to the barricades is what I say.
Fair enough. I mean, in season 6, I'm definitely going to be asking people how many tweets they've made. So, yeah.
What are they called now? Is it X's? Like
posts and reposts.
Come on,
just like Facebook and Instagram, all that stuff, boring stuff.
Well, with that in mind, there's the capacity to continue the conversation. The first question says, what strategies do you find most effective for maintaining a positive and inclusive classroom environment?
I mean, I am just grumpy old man syndrome. So whether or not that is a positive environment or not, I don't know. But, you know, kids seem to be able to thrive in it. So, you know, perhaps just being your authentic self and not going over the top is one of the best ways to make that, you know, be real with everything. I remember on my when I was training on one of my, it's been like my second school placement while at university, there was a male teacher who would just give nothing away, like talk about like don't smile until Christmas. Like I just never saw this person like smile in front of the kids. He looked like the grumpiest person on earth, who just didn't like want to be there or anything like that. And even the deputy head like said, like, you know, he looks like this, but you know, this is far from what he's actually like. Don't judge a book by the cover kind of thing. He looks like he doesn't care, but oh my god, like he's one of the hardest working teachers here, whatever works for him, like, and like kids just adapt to his like sense of like dry sense of humor and stuff like that. And so that was quite an important thing for me, in the sense that yes, you can do various bits and pieces to make sure people feel you know, included, particularly from a sort of before they join. Obviously leaders can do a fair little bit beforehand, but in terms of, I guess, from the teacher perspective, I think there's a lot of just being your true authentic self, and I think kids do appreciate that. When, and I think, or maybe it's just certainly perhaps a scar on my acting abilities, but whenever I've tried to overhype and, you know, be that overexcited person to try and, you know, keep that engagement and kind of make people feel included, they've seen through it straight away and just give me some weird looks. So I've, from the teaching perspective, yeah, just be your true authentic self, and the rest kind of, you know, takes care of itself, really.
I'm surprised your acting isn't that good, considering you went to art school for 3 years.
Well, I mean, I'm GCSE drama, A-level drama. I didn't do rugby on Sundays. I was at amateur dramatics, you know. But the real thing is that my acting is, you know, pretty amazing, really. Just the kids just don't, you know, kids don't appreciate it.
No, yeah. But in all seriousness, I think you raise a really important point, because positive doesn't mean being their friends. Positive doesn't mean bending to their every will. Positive means consistency. You know, the lines you draw are the lines that keep the kids safe and the lines that keep the classroom productive, and a clear investment in their, in the pupils' needs and their education, you know. So positive means we're all going to work hard towards the same goal. And yeah. I guarantee you'll all get there because I'm a teacher. So I think, you know, we can be self-deprecating, but I don't think you should be, Neil, because, you know, I would do the same thing. I call myself boring in inverted commas, I think, in thinking to be preparing mathematics, but I don't think I'm boring. I just think I have my personality, but I also know how to support kids in getting the most from their time in my classroom. So I think very important points, Neil.
I agree with Neil as well. I think that, you know, being your true self is definitely really important, because the minute you start trying to, like Neil said, put on an act, is where it starts to fall apart. And what I would potentially say is that there is definitely a sort of a time and place for feigning some enthusiasm, I think, because the sort of strategies we can use for helping children to feel a bit less pressured in the classroom situation and so on and so forth. I know Chris has spoken about it before, things like, you know, where you said, oh, you know, I used to struggle with this. And, you know, these sorts of strategies to help children to come on board and create that kind of inclusive practice. And, you know, the things he said, I think the other thing he said was, say, oh, yeah, this worked from year six or whatever, you know, like if they're in year four, or little things like that, where you can help children to feel comfortable, because they need to know you care about them as well. Of course, like, you do need to have that rapport. But like Neil said, the rapport isn't jazz hands, cartwheels in the classroom, because that's not, you know, you're not, one, you're going to burn out trying to do that. And I think you also just need to, you also do need to measure and temper yourself a little bit from, like Kieran said, they aren't your friends. And if you're a new teacher and you're stepping in, you're thinking, I'm going to bring my big personality to this class, that's great, come with that energy, but just be mindful about how personal you want to be. I know teacher TikTok has been doing the rounds lately over the last couple of days, and there's a lot to be said there for how you are with your children and things like, you know, and you can show that you care by getting them to be successful. That's what the first and foremost is, like, if they feel successful with you, they start to trust you. And I'll just draw a parallel at the minute that sort of, as Neil was speaking, made me think. I'm watching The Bear at the moment on Disney, and it's a fantastic show if you haven't, anybody hasn't seen it. And the character development in it, and the way that there's some really difficult characters, and I know this is completely fictional and adults, but the way that they are professional in their work environment as chefs, and they build that kind of trust through being successful in the kitchen. I don't know. It's kind of I just draw a parallel with that in terms of like how you build that success with children. So it makes them feel like, oh yeah, I fit in here. This is okay. I think the other thing I would add is, I know Peps in his book about motivation talks about norms and culture in the room that you want to try and create, and trying to create that environment where other children want to feel successful, like they want to fit in with the main group. And if you can get the main group, and it comes back to those routines then that we spoke of, isn't it? If we can get the main group believing and having a certain ethos, it brings everybody into the fold, because you've created the right culture and the norms in the room. So I'll probably add that as well.
Yeah, just a few other things. One more kind of thing from the teacher perspective. Real simple one, but a real difficult one to get into the habit, is to stop using the language of like I, you, mine, and use like just we and our. So like in our class instead of in my class. It's not you, you will be silent during independent work. It's like we will be silent. So just kind of like small little things like that just kind of, you know, infuse the whole kind of, you know, we're working on this kind of common goal, you know, together, and for it to work, we all need to, you know, come together, and we all have a part to play, Lloyd said, you know, in creating those social norms. So a nice small little thing, I think, but again, quite a difficult one to get into the habit of. You kind of always need to kind of check yourself when you do it, is to say, use that inclusive language that kind of assumes that you are one homogeneous group rather than you know, teacher, children. You know, that hierarchy evidently does exist and should exist, obviously. But I think using that inclusive language of our class, you know, we need to do this, is pretty useful. Useful as well then when you need to do least invasive interventions and stuff like that to kind of like reset, then, you know, it's a simple one. It's not oi, you. It's, you know, let's stop there, everyone. In our class, we do this. So nice kind of anonymous reminders. In terms of what leaders can do, there's evidently, you know, quite a fair little bit behind the scenes. I think for me, the most kind of important thing that teachers can do, that leaders can do, is just make sure that your systems for like handover are really pretty solid, whether you choose to do that, you know, towards the end of the academic year, or perhaps, you know, in the insets that you might have before the beginning of the academic year. I think that those mechanisms that you put in place to make sure that those handovers that you get between different teachers are really kind of as effective as they can be. I'm sure Lloyd has thought about that side of it far more deeply than I have, and has some really great mechanisms for how to make that work in practice. But it needs to be more than just you know, a bit of paper and last year's data for me. You know, you need to make sure that you are making sure that any strategies that have worked with previous pupils that struggle to maintain that positivity, you know, those are shared in advance, and teachers have the time to implement whatever those strategies are to kind of help that from that inclusivity side of it.
You guys both teach someone else's class for part of the week. Is that a different experience? Do you have to set your own culture, or do you try and assimilate into the culture that already exists? It helps, you're both deputy heads in that situation, aren't you?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, and we're quite hot over this with our teachers in terms of finding, making sure that any cover where possible and planned, like, so where I do a PPA cover or whatever, I know exactly what, like, what the routine, I ask the teachers ahead, like, what exactly the routines look like, and what, you know, I try and find out as much detail as I can before going in to make sure that I run it the same as they do. So there's a consistency there with me coming in and picking up the cues that, you know, the cues that they use as much as I possibly can, and in line with all of our policies and things. And I think that's really, really important. And we try and do the same for our HLTAs as well, and make sure we allow some time for our teachers to speak to our HLTAs, so that they know the same things that they're going, and they see a lot, you know, they go into a lot of classrooms, and they, you know, whilst you've got consistency across the board, people have slightly different things that they do. And we like give teacher autonomy on some of that stuff. But we make sure that then, like I say, that consistency is there, because it's really, really important, like you say, to know about the class for starters, to know who, you know, what you're looking out for, and to know that the cues that they've put in place and they practice and reinforce every day, they're going to be more effective than you trying to come in with a new one over the top of it. So I think that's a really important part. And again, that comes back to what Neil was saying around induction and around sort of handover, you know, practices, which are really, really, really important. And like Neil said, it's not just about, you know, here's the page of notes and here's the data and let's just talk through this for 40 minutes and then we're on our way. You know, it's about, like you say, putting the trying to think long term about how you can mitigate some of that stuff from a leader's perspective. So things like having shorter build up sessions where you go and observe now the difficulty with this is if there's people coming in, this is more tricky, where staff are staying the same, you know, where there's not lots of movement, wherever you can, building in internal short visits to the classroom, building up observations. You know, this we had a whole sort of 6-week program that we put in, but it depends on how many. We had a bit more movement this year, so we weren't able to run it this year like we did last year. I think it constantly evolves that. I think you kind of need to have, as a leader, as the last thing I say on it is, I would have like a sort of rough framework of transition of what you are able to do when lots of people leave, or able to do when nobody leaves, and kind of adapt every year based on what you can sort of what you can reach from that framework, sort of thing. So I sort of probably would say is worthwhile from a leadership perspective.
Just going back to that first point of the question again, I try to assimilate into whatever routines are there. Can't say I'm always very successful because I've taught phonics many a times. We use Sounds Right. And if I don't do it exactly the way that the teacher does it, those group of year two children will put their hand up and say, this isn't the way that Miss whoever, you know, does it. Why are you doing it this way? Which, I mean, that shows you that kid knows what those routines are and they like that routine. And yeah, you do have to pull out the, I'm really sorry, you know, for now we're going to do it this way. But then you go and tell the teacher and be like, you know, and then up to you then to make sure you kind of learn exactly what that routine is, because although the essence of these kind of phonics lessons are the same, Obviously, you know, teachers do bring their own sets of skills and personality to those lessons as well. And, you know, like Lloyd said as well, if you're there at the end of the day, it's okay, what's your end of the day routine? What's your, it's before lunchtime and you know, okay, what's your routine for, you know, getting the kids, you know, ready? You know, what does that look like? What time, you know, do I need to stop this lesson? Because if you don't tell me that, I'm going to take this lesson, you know, if lunch starts at 11:30, I'm going to take this to the wire. And then that might then mean that, because I don't know how long it takes for those kids to do that transition. If that goes wrong, that means then, you know, the impact that then has on lunch break. If you've got a class of 30 going to lunch, you know, possibly just, you know, 5-7 minutes late, you know, you've got to somehow then make up that time and get them through that lunch either quicker, or just kind of snowball and delay everyone else. So understanding it, particularly I think at those kind of real kind of key points, so before break, if you're picking them up from break, before lunch, home time, understanding what the routines of that class are key. And yeah, you should definitely go with what the teachers are doing rather than going in and using your own routines if it's a kind of ad hoc basis.
I think that'll be really helpful. I think not just for beginning teachers, but you know, for anyone really who's considering the both the effective maintenance of a positive and inclusive classroom environment, but also teachers are going to have to manage other teachers teaching their classes at some point, and that can sometimes be a pinch point. So just time to consider that, I think, would be really, really helpful. The next question, I think, is also worth considering with your teaching responsibility in mind, because it'll be the teaching that is most fresh in your mind. Someone has said that there's an expectation that we effectively differentiate instruction to meet the diverse needs of students or pupils in our classes. What does that look like in your class?
In terms of differentiation and pitch and where instructions play, you know, sort of where you place your instruction, if you will. Because I guess there's two things here, isn't there? There's the instruction and then there's the task that is the that needs consideration as well. I would say that you know, the bottom line, it depends on, you know, it always depends on the cohort in terms of what you've got in front of you, in terms of, you know, attainment and where children are in terms of how and where you pitch. But you've got to pitch to, I would say, you know, to the middle, you know, because otherwise you're going to end up alienating somebody, a larger group. So my approach is to like graduate your input so that it starts bringing everybody in and moves up to a more sort of meatier part in the middle section with that, the depth of questioning there as you're moving along. And that would probably be echoed in the task design as well, having a task which is, you know, build success early on for everybody, but a real depth to it that allows children to go, and that start point might not look the same for all children from when they set off to the task. You know, they might not necessarily, depending on where they are in the sequence of learning and depending on your kind of your kind of formative assessment about where they are, I would say you need to consider carefully where you start children from. If they're fluent in something or they can do something, they know something, then consider about starting them further on rather than always going. Now, there are times where you do need to check and you do need to start at the beginning with all children. But I would say you know your children, and when you're further into a topic or a unit or something, you know which children through assessment, through your ongoing formative assessment, are further along and have a deeper understanding and wider understanding. So it's having that confidence to say, actually, yeah, I'm going to start them further along, and targeting those questions to those, you know, so that they, not at them necessarily. I mean, you can cold call and you can do that, but like having the questions that open up a sort of wider or like allow for depth. And that takes some careful consideration in terms of the planning of the questions you want to ask, not just going off the hoof. And that comes down to the planning phase, I guess. It's a broad question, isn't it? It's quite difficult. It's quite difficult to sum it. I'm like in my head, I'm flitting between history and geography, then to maths and English, and it's just all ping around. I'm trying to sort of give some advice that is kind of homogenous in that sense. My opinion is to go to the middle. You know, buy everybody in with some early success, but generally keep the thrust of the lesson in the middle with extending probing kind of questions and similar with the depth in task design. Neil, I don't know how you feel about it. You might completely disagree.
I agree, Lloyd. It's a totally tricky one. Whoever wrote this question clearly has a particular cohort in mind when they think about this. They obviously may have a very different idea to what differentiation is in terms of, are they talking about, you know, three-way different kind of task? Is it some might, most might, everyone will kind of success criteria? And obviously, you know, diverse needs. We're talking, you know, severe SCN here, or are we kind of just talking about kind of your average, you know, depending on what class they're in, that could be obviously, you know, 2 or 3 year kind of development behind from the highest to the lowest, or, you know, potentially even more, 5 or 6 years if we're talking up a key stage two. Again, I personally don't think we kind of, unless the age, the kind of developmental gap in the particular subject that you're teaching. Now, that might be different for within the different subjects. For maths, they, you know, some children might be kind of, you know, 5, 6 years behind in English, perhaps only 2 or 3 years behind reading, whatever it might be. I think depending on that gap kind of depends your kind of route of action. If they are only ever so slightly behind, then, you know, you're not differentiating by task or anything like that. You are, you know, planning, being really, really clear what you want kids to learn in that lesson. You're really, really clear how you're going to scaffold and support that. You're clear as to what your explanation is going to be. You're clear about that questioning. You are really, particularly, I think, questioning those children who you need to support. You're clear about any, if it's maths, any manipulatives that you're going to use. Plenty of whiteboard work for that formative assessment, so you can do, you know, 3 worked examples, realize that this group of 7 over here are fine, so you can go, right, you guys, you know, you have a pop at these kind of questions, this little group here, we're going to do a few more examples, I, we, you kind of style, kind of, you know, guidance faded and all of that stuff. If the attainment gap is particularly big, I'm not, depending on what you're teaching, I'm not too sure, particularly more hierarchical subjects like maths. If I really do have children who generally can't tell me like what half or a quarter means, and I'm in year 5 and I'm teaching them how to find fractions of amounts, that's what the scheme of work says, then I'd be really kind of hesitant to try and scaffold success for those children who don't know what a half or a quarter are, purely because I just kind of think you're building on sands. You get them through the lesson, but they don't take anything away from it at all. You know, they can perform really well. You know, it's that classic performance versus learning. They perform really well in that lesson. You give yourself a little pat on the back, but really, do those kids come out knowing any more than you don't, more, do they come out of that lesson knowing any more or understanding more about the nature of fractionness than they did beforehand? I honestly don't think they would do that. So I probably would then, you know, consider ideally either doing some pre-teaching to kind of fill that gap in as quickly as you can, or if you kind of do need to have them in with the main inputs. But, you know, you're doing that kind of real kind of sleight of hand, you know, differentiation by stealth kind of thing. So you are just getting them to do, you know, finding half of like, you know, real simple quantities and stuff like that. So, you know, the minutiae that back in the day, you know, back in the early 2000s, if you weren't screaming, I am differentiating to you, the observer wouldn't pick up at all. And they'd just go, oh, so where's your differentiation in that lesson? Well, actually, if you bothered to talk to me first before writing down that you know, target, I'll be able to tell you exactly how I differentiated for that class. But again, as Lloyd says, you know, that can change from subject to subject. You know, in history, which is quite, you know, vertical in terms of its the structure, you know, if they don't understand They don't know, you know, that the Romans first tried to invade under Julius Caesar in 55 and 54 BC before Claudius arrived. It's not the end of the world. Quite honestly, in primary, you know, you can say, you know, being real and honest, you can say, you know, differentiate, you know, keep everyone together, but you'll only put yourself in an early grave and decide to metaphorically and be out of that, be out of the profession within 5 years if you go to, you know, differentiate to, you know, the nth degree. So I would say for those main kind of things, if the attainment gap isn't so large, just solid, good, you know, old school tier one, quality one, wave one, you know, good teaching. If it's quite an attainment gap, then really kind of consider how you can kind of differentiate within the unit of learning that you're doing, you know, differentiate it in a way that's not so obvious and kind of meets the needs of those particular pupils. Because I say, you can, you know, I've taught many children who don't understand really, you know, if you ask them to bend a bit of paper in half, they couldn't really do it, but I could get them through, okay, we're going to find five sevenths of 35. I could, you know, here's a multiplication, you know, grid. I'll show you how to use that to do that. And then obviously, you know, they kind of feel successful because they're doing it. But there's no sort of deep learning going on there. So,
I mean, it's an impossible question. You know, I think if you look at the sum total of the episodes we've done with a teaching and learning focus, you're probably drawing something from all of them. You know, the systems people put in place, the guiding principles they have, you know, I'm thinking about the early seasons where we were very much thinking about teaching and learning in almost all the episodes. Going to those and looking at those first initial questions and thinking, well, how do all these pieces fit together? Because ultimately what we're trying to avoid is increased workload through ineffective practices, like you say, Neil. Three is probably an underestimate of the number of activities that most people would have had to make at some point in their career, certainly if you've been teaching for a while. So we want to avoid that, but also we want to meet the needs of people in our classes. And it's thinking about the systems and structures and the approach that we have. I think you guys have done a valiant job of answering it. I just wanted, you know, when I saw the question, I was like, well, I know what my answer is, but let's put it to Lloyd and Neil and see what they think. So, I mean, I think this one is one that pulls on your strengths. What are the best practices for collaborating with other teachers and staff members to develop school culture so that it's cohesive and collaborative? Again, a summary of the actual question that I was asked.
I think it's all about your communication. It all comes down to that and how easy you are making it for teachers to communicate with other teachers, which is hard in a trust. It's even harder if you're in a local authority school, as Lloyd is, because you're kind of, you know, we have the connections. We know there's in STEP, you know, there are 19 other schools that, you know, are easily contactable. We know people within those already. Obviously Lloyd and you know, Lucy will have connections with local schools, but, you know, they're kind of inbuilt into the trust model, which isn't to say that it's easy at all, because it can be very insular even when you're working in a little trust, particularly a little one form entry like I was in the past academic year. So it is really making sure that your communication channels are easy for teachers to talk with each other, and that doesn't mean an email, that means, you know, other means as well, because half the battle is actually, well, okay, I want to talk to someone in year two in school B. You know, it needs to be really easy for teachers to find who is teaching in year two in school B for them to do that, because if it's any kind of mental effort, you know, it's gonna go down to that priority, down to the bottom of that priority list quite quickly. So streamlining all forms of communication I'm trying something next academic year with using like Microsoft Teams to kind of really kind of make sure we use that far better than we do. I think some schools have it, some schools don't. But I do kind of like the feature set that's on Teams to enable people to do this. It's a bit of setting up, but I think it's going to be really effective. Something that schools are doing, saying you listen to the episode that had Matt Swain on. He talks a lot about how he's been able to build a real kind of culture of collaboration down in a few of our schools through things like shared PPA. So there's five schools there, which I think total around eight forms of entry. And within those eight forms of entry, you know, PPA is guaranteed at the same time. Perhaps somewhat controversially, there is a bit of directed time within that PPA to have a conversation with your peers about the planning that you've done in preparation for the next week. But I think the kind of the sacrifice of giving kind of that kind of 20 minutes being directed you know, has really benefited the teachers who have been kind of trialing that particular model, in the sense that, you know, they're all singing off the same hymn sheet, you know, in terms of the expectations for what a lesson should look like, in terms of what the kind of resources are going to be available for teachers to kind of teach that lesson, to really kind of help and support, you know, teacher workload. So, you know, down there, say there's eight forms of entry. So, you know, it's not like in a little one form entry school where poor year five teacher has to plan, you know, 11 subjects perhaps at one go. There's kind of, you're in an eight form entry school effectively, and you're kind of putting in systems and mechanisms in place to make sure that it's not the case of just, you know, teacher comes in, downloads the lesson slides and the worksheet off the, you know, 2 minutes before the, you know, the kids arrive, and the first time that they see that is when, you know, the first time they see the lesson slides or the worksheet or the lesson plan, whatever it is. Shouldn't say lesson plan because we don't use lesson plans. But the first time they see any kind of resources to turn that lesson into reality isn't the same time as the kids. So I think it's teachers certainly don't mind it, you know, 20 minutes of their PPA time being spent to just make sure that everyone benefits from that planning. So I would say, yeah, communication structures, just make them as straightforward and as easy as possible. And there are loads of ways to do it. As I say, we're experimenting with kind of aligned PPA across a couple of our schools, and we're expanding that to a few more in September. And I've got my little project about how we can greater utilize Microsoft Teams to kind of support in that as well.
There's some great functionality on there, because you can do things like the files you share during a call will be grouped by that call, and you can continue the conversation within that little group, or you can filter it into your other, the other bits. The only thing with Teams is that you're not 100% guaranteed to be allowed into the call in the first place. I don't know if that's libelous, but certainly in my experience, I want to join. I've got a suitable email address, but I just don't get in with the frequency that I do in other places.
Yeah, it's quite. I've had that as well. It's quite tight, the security in, within the organization, isn't it? So it can pose problems at times collaborating when you externally.
Is that what it is? Right. Okay. So I need to apologize to the Microsoft Corporation and all subsidiaries. I thought it was their fault.
No, it's large. I often get it, and there's certain things, links and things we can't share outside the organization, and they're quite tight. You know, it's GDPR and all the rest of it. Some great points here from Neil. Really, really pertinent stuff. I would probably add to what he said about Teams. You know, the systems, communication systems, is really, really important. I completely echo that. I think having a really clear understanding of what is used and when. So we did a staff survey this year and spoke to our staff, and it became quite clear that they were mixed between emails and Teams. And we went back and we're like, right, we need to redefine this a little bit better. So we wrote a comms policy, and we got staff to input into that as well, in terms of what that included, things like email, kind of email behavior, you know, in terms of like what we agree as a staff in terms of when and how, and we've all come to agreement on that, which is, it's the first place I've ever worked where it's been
quite consistently like, yeah, all right, we'll do that. And everybody seems to be okay with it. So those things are really, really important because they kind of foster that that ability to work collaboratively. And if things are too one-sided for anybody, then that's what it falls apart, isn't it? So I think, you know, and things start to break down in terms of collaboration. I think, you know, having like Neil said, you know, alongside something like Teams, you're having your like shared area, your shared systems, your SharePoint or whatever it is you use, your shared drives, well organized and structured and accessible as well, remotely, but obviously in a safe way, you know, obviously authenticated two-factor and all the rest of it. But having that accessibility makes things better as well. I think that's really, really important. And I'd probably tack on to that as well the time to collaborate. So then when we ask teachers to do something and do, you know, we need to think about when they can do that. You know, some things we just have to direct and we say we need this done by X, but where we can possibly do it, you know, we do things like where there's the odd time where we might have to collapse an SDI for that day to give that 20 minutes to staff if it's that important to collaborate. We don't do it that often, and we'll only do it like in a case where we need to do something urgent perhaps, but there is that, you know, you have a fail-safe built in to allow you that. Also, I've talked about it before, but having planning days built in is a massive plus for us for collaboration, you know, in terms of how our leaders, subject leaders, then work with the year group teams, and the year group teams are planning 6 days a year, you know, together for a day, working on plans and subject knowledge and so on and so forth, and task designs and that sense of things. I think in terms of, like Neil said, the wider collaboration out, I think you need to be really mindful of the partnerships you form and the remits that sit around those partnerships, and that they're authentic and that they're clear and that they're driven in a way which is agreed by all parties, so that it isn't a case of, oh, we're just rocking up at this school and we'll pretend to do some things today and that'll be just because we're ticking the box of collaboration. They're actually meaningful. They're actually agendaed. They're actually, you know, they're purposeful and everybody's getting something out of them. I think that because they're hard to organize, you know, particularly like I say, I'm speaking from an LA perspective, it can be really challenging. I know probably Neil would echo this as well. There's probably a danger sometimes within certain trusts that central teams also, you know, you've got to be careful with how they lose their kind of their purchase and leverage on what's going on the ground, because they swirl around in this middle ground where they're not in schools and they kind of like exist in that space. So I guess I can't speak from experience. I got to be honest, and they'll be the person to chip in on that one. But I could imagine there. Well, I know, having spoken to people, that there can be challenges, I think, around where central teams aren't potentially having the purchase, you know, a geography team or whatever, like that aren't having the purchase that were perhaps desired. So I think that's something that's really, really important. I think that probably the last thing I would say is about, from a leadership perspective, again, just about how you encourage your distribution and leadership, how you cascade things down to other leaders and make sure that everybody is like collaborating, so it's not falling all on one person to do too much of the heavy lifting, because that's when people snap. So making sure that those things, you know, things like steering groups and working parties, kind of goes back to what I was just saying there from a trust perspective, where you've got a central team, having a steering group or a working party. But again, caveat being, if you do run those things, they can be immensely powerful with the right agendering and the right leading of those groups. You can produce some incredible things, but it's got to be done in the right way. So I would say that they can foster real collaboration, but with the right culture and the right like tightness almost and sharpness in those groups.
That was an invitation to put Matt Swain under the sword. Has he lost touch? Huge if true.
No comment there. I'm out.
Yeah, no comment either. I would say the other thing that makes life, again, just think about making life easier, is whether you choose to use like Microsoft or Google or whatever, just make sure that you're using like cloud versions of documents, because speaking from massive experience here, it is a pain in the you know what when you want to edit a document. You have to go onto like your school
version 79 in the thread.
Yeah, and it's just like, yeah, either it says like so, and you can't open this document, it's opened by someone else, and you're thinking, okay. And then you open that folder.
Okay, can I ask a question then? When that happens, you get three options, don't you? You get what it's like, close it down. You get like,
don't bother.
Merge.
Risk it if you want to.
What do you click? I click the merge, and then the crazy thing, and then it's all like, these changes have been made. Do you want to accept these ones? And you've done this. And it's like, it's a moral conundrum. I'm like, I just want to close it down, mate. I just want to open the document app. Like, I don't want to like have an existential crisis about the bloody geography planning, you know, like, yeah, sorry, gone off.
I have never clicked the merge button just for fear of not knowing what's going to happen.
Have you clicked it, Kat? Have you clicked it?
No, I don't think so. I just keep it closed.
Am I the merger?
I think you need a t-shirt for Deutschland that says, I merge.
I merge.
I don't think there's going to be any new teacher, you know, teacher who's going into the profession now, 21, who's going to understand what this reference is, you know, because I can't remember the last time I worked with a document that wasn't on the cloud in some form.
The good old days, eh?
Well, when I started teaching, you couldn't take your laptop home because it all had to be on the school's internet system to actually work. Yeah. So you literally couldn't do. You had to stay in school as long as you possibly could if you wanted to work on stuff.
Different times.
Yeah. Emailing yourself loads of stuff, like, and then like opening it, doing it all at home, re-emailing it back to yourself, then opening it all in school. Like, come on, man, it's disgusting, isn't it? Like, it's...
And then the next step was that you could take it home, but you only had a locally saved version, and there had to be a big upload on the Monday morning when you went back in to the school system. Yeah, I mean, I can't believe that. I mean, this is in the 21st century.
It is ridiculous. So it makes everyone's life easier to just embrace. I know it's not the most beautiful way to navigate your files, but, you know, OneDrive, the benefits of using, you know, cloud-based documents far outweigh any potential, you know, negative. You know, the feature set, you know, there's so much... there's so many collaborative features, you know, built into these things now. You know, if we were, I'm sure people know this, this is probably part of the problem. It just kind of feels like we're teaching, you know, people to suck eggs here. But, you know, if we were all working on a document together, we're all doing it at the same time, you know, Lloyd makes a change to one paragraph, I'd be able to see it. There's usually like an instant, like a chat function now within the document as well. So we can, if Lloyd deleted a certain paragraph, I can go, are you sure you wanted to delete that? You know, straight away, I can see what everyone's doing. You know, it just makes life so much easier because all three of us can edit documents. So again, if you are planning collaboratively and perhaps you're in a fortunate position where perhaps you're mentoring an ECT, and perhaps whatever reason, you know, it might be the case that the CCT is in a different year group, whatever it is, you can be like, right, okay, we can at least kind of collaborate through the cloud. I'll teach you through taking how to, you know, make a decent worksheet that has, you know, some principles of variation theory in it. And you can, you know, usually as well with Teams and Meets, you know, you can do a video chat at the same time as well. So you don't just have to type in the message. You know, there really is a lot of benefits here too. Aiding in that collaborative effort that, you know, really are, you know, low hanging fruit. I don't know of a single school that doesn't now use, you know, some form of Microsoft 365 or uses the Google Suite. I just don't think there's any excuse for it not to happen, because again, it's the easy, I think, for leadership, like, you just need to make things easy for people to do. And if it's easy and it's not difficult and they don't need to think about it, they will do it. You know, it's why I like these things as well. I'm not going to tell people that they need to work from home. But if they can access these things on the cloud in the comfort of their own home, then when they want to do some work at home because they're choosing to, I've made it easier for them to do it. And so I really kind of think streamlining everything and look at everything through the lens, you know, what is the path of least resistance to make sure that teachers can do what they need to do? And so, as I say, like, communication, make sure that every teacher there's a centralized list that has the names, email addresses, and roles across like your schools. Make that really easy for them to know who that is. Cloud-based working, et cetera, make it easy for them and they'll do it.
Nice. So essentially it's, we agree that this is something the teacher should do. What can we put in place to make it as the path of least resistance for them to do so? Yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. Now, I had one more question, but I can see you're getting annoyed, Lord. The nod, Lloyd.
No, Lord. Do you just call me Lord?
I said you got the annoyed, Lord.
No. Change my name immediately to Lord Bones Jones, please. No, I'm not getting the nod. No, I've just sent you to come through to get a cup of coffee or something. Like tea or, I don't know, what are you getting?
Lord Bones Jones.
Coffee at 9:45.
Nah, she's not getting, she's literally putting the cup.
He's lying.
Yeah, no, she's going to bed now. I can do third question.
You sure?
Yeah.
I mean, that was fourth. So the next question is just for you, Lloyd, because Neil and I have answered this question over a couple of recent episodes. What strategies do you use to assess and monitor student progress effectively?
Good question. You know, you've got to be really careful with data, haven't you? I think we know from the data busting from Richard and Jamie, just how sort of unreliable data can be. Yet we do have to do something, don't we? As leaders, we do have to kind of have an idea of what's going on with our children. So I guess the first thing is, you know, weighing the pig and all that doesn't make you fatter, you know. And I think having multiple data drops across a year, you know, in terms of like 6 data drops a year and things, isn't going to help you. For us, like the biggest kind of line in the sand are the end year NFER standardized papers that we do. And we're really clear with our teachers. We set those in proper conditions. They're not gamed. They're not, you know, we're very clear with our teachers about that in terms of, you know, you're not looking at the paper ahead of it and teaching bits the week before. You know, it's got to be really done honestly and fairly. I think it's not perfect. I think where perhaps your math schemes don't align to what you're assessing with can be a problem. In terms of content coverage and so on and so forth. It's like any test, isn't it? You know, we know from the SATs, you know, it's only as good as it's written. But in terms of an end year kind of line in the sand, alongside, you know, some other low stakes bits and pieces that we pull together for our pupil progress. For example, like our quizzing across the year, you know, we collate and store an insight how they've done on all of the end topic tests, and we do those, and they're all put. So when you come to that end year picture, you've kind of got a sort of 12 or 13 of the topics that run across their NFER standardized score, and this is where insight is absolutely beautiful for this kind of stuff, because you can present just a picture of a child all the way across, kind of put all this stuff together, then have that conversation with the teacher and go, okay, so this presents something. How do you feel? Does that represent that in terms of what you're seeing from them in class? You know, and you have that kind of like constructive conversation around the progress of a pupil. And I think that's, you know, that's really, really important. So like with reading, for example, when we're looking at our, you know, when we track all of our fluency, our words per minute, our accuracy, our sort of standardized scores in the NFER for their reading comprehension. And we sort of, we put all that as a running sort of table across the year. So you can see, and which was quite lovely as well, is where you've got children who perhaps haven't, you know, are not working within the standard of the year group. you can see massive progress in their words per minute and their accuracy. And you go, actually, look, they've made huge gains here. And they've moved out of the phonics group, which we also track in Insight. It's beautiful. I know I'm like plugging Insight here, but like I can't tell you enough how good that program is for shaping assessment for what you need it to do and presenting a picture that can be discussed with the teacher. It's the best I've ever used, you know, with hands down, because it's flexible, because it's malleable, and because I'm able to just ask it to do what we want it to do. So I think they're really important things when you're considering like how you assess the progress across a year. Obviously, you've got your formative strategies, like Neil mentioned before, you know, where you day-to-day responsive stuff. But in terms of like more summative and more like long-term signal finding, if you will, I think like that for us, we found it really, really useful. I know we've talked before, Neil, about attendance as well, you know, and how much that PA and different things like that can have an impact on a child's learning, you know, and how much has been missed. And we have like, we've now added to our, we've gone a bit step further now. So instead of just having the percentages of where they are, we have a running tracker. So we've got every child. And as the weeks of the year go on, if they've dipped into red or you can literally see the journey of every child through the year. So you can go, oh, actually, you go, oh, they've got lower attendance. But, well, actually, no, they haven't, because that attendance dip was in the autumn two, and now we're in summer one, and the last 6, 8, 10 weeks have been green. So really, we can't say, because there is that potential, isn't there? You know, when we're discussing, oh, they're never here. But look at the attendance, it's 70. So, well, hang on. No, that's not quite the picture, is it? Because they were off here, but they've been in consistently for that part. So that's been something that we've learned and iterated with that. It's been really, really, really useful for us. I'll be honest, like Lucy's driven that 100%. Lucy's driven attendance. That's probably another conversation altogether. We've reduced our PAs quite a bit this year through some quite, and it's hard. Like, you know, attendance is really hard. It's really hard. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of input. But we have brought it down, and that's just helped us though be even more forensic with our assessment and with our discussions around children. So it's a big question, isn't it? In terms of the wider, there's a whole episode here, isn't it? In terms of assessment in the wider, I mean, you know, we know it's questionable to say the least, isn't it? But that's one of our big key areas for our SLP next year. Is kind of considering what our profile for assessment in the wider is and kind of what the diet and each policy, subject policy is for it. Even though we know, as we know, you asked the inspector what a GD RE in year four looks like. Don't think there's an answer there, as it's been well documented before on the pod. But yeah, that's kind of probably how I would roughly answer that question. I don't know if I've hit the mark, is it? That's kind of where we're at as a school, kind of our thinking around it.
Nice. There probably is an attendance episode at least in there somewhere, because yeah, I've been in plenty of pupil progress meetings where attendance has been used as the reason why pupil hasn't made sort of progress over across a year. But yeah, I think you raised some really interesting points. I wonder if the person asked the question hadn't used the word progress, would you have gone as directly to summative as you did? Because in my head, I interpret it as if, you know, well, what do I do in the classroom? What does Lloyd do in his maths lessons with year sixes and that kind of thing? I mean, obviously, I don't want you to answer it now, but perhaps next time I might ask the same. Next time we're doing some unseen questions.
Yeah. Now, line that up. So it's my interpretation of the question. Sorry, like, I was just thinking.
No, there's no wrong interpretation.
Yeah, I think the word progress kind of made me think. It just skewed me to that, I think. I find that quite interesting. And I find like I'm always interested in what other schools do as well, in terms of, I'd love to hear what other people do in terms of how they, because the bottom line is we have to come to judgments, don't we? We have to report on judgments at the end of the year in our reports. We have to submit them. Well, not in Casey's one anymore, but you know, so it's kind of like how people come to that judgment. I'm almost quite fascinated by those sort of practices and what, because we know this, that they're so noisy and so kind of can be so unreliable, really.
There's a great podcast with the Data Busters and Becky Allen. It's a two-parter. And they talk about this, and you know, Becky Allen being Becky Allen just, you know, kills it. Like, she puts like really good reasons out there, like why like standardized assessments aren't a good thing. And I'm like, oh, that's quite interesting. And so they kind of, the data busters kind of ask her like, okay, so like, what's like, what in your mind is like a really like good thing, you know, that's kind of like out there. And she's a massive fan of like the timetable rock stars, like heat maps. And she reckons like those heat maps are far more better, far more useful way to think about progress than anything else that like she's kind of come across, because effectively like what it does is it just measures, it's not pitting you against someone else, it's just literally your own progress. Like at the beginning of the year they were all orange, and now, you know, 7/10 of the it is like green, so great, you know, boom, like there's your progress right there, nice and easy. So I've been really kind of thinking you know, quite deeply about how, you know, maybe there's a something in that for other subjects as well, this idea of like a heat map. But I need my ed tech friends to come and help me with that one, because I think it's the only way that you'd be able to possibly think it through, unless you did some like conditional formatting on like Excel or something like that maybe. But I thought that was quite an interesting way to kind of, you know, how you might want to do it, is kind of thinking about, you know, the use of heat maps. So I can kind of see how you might have, you know, obviously it works really well in like maths for just like timetables, like number bonds and 20 and stuff, but even kind of more conceptual things like adding like fractions. So you could just have this idea of adding fractions, then kind of within adding fraction, there's all like those different like interpretations of what adding fractions might mean, from, you know, unit fractions to non-unit fractions to unit fraction and mixed number and all that stuff. And so obviously the higher, the better that kids kind of do that, the more green like this bigger idea of just adding fractions actually is. And so from that you can kind of see how children are progressing that way, which I thought was quite an interesting way of doing it. There's probably a blog in there perhaps somewhere as a kind of with a bit of a, you know, prototype perhaps done really badly in Photoshop to what I want to what I mean by it, just basically ripping off Becky Allen as all the best thinkers would do. Yes.
Now, be careful, Neil, because we also mentioned heat maps before listening to that episode. And obviously our next natural step is to monetize this idea. So it's on the record as, you know, we had this idea independently.
Oh, great. Perfect.
But also we're going to hold it against anyone who does it after this episode, because if they take our idea and don't cut us in, well, then we will litigate, always litigate, and then ask questions.
Lawyer. I was like, we need to build it, but a prototype quite quickly, Kieran.
Yeah, don't blog about it. We're gonna.
That's interesting. That's really interesting, actually. Yeah, I can see. Like, I guess it's difficult, isn't it? Because like, the system isn't geared to have a heat map at the end of it, and all the time that it doesn't have any heat map at the end of it, it is going to be difficult. It's going to be a difficult sell, isn't it? And I guess shifting. I agree with you. I think I completely can see the sense in that. I guess, you know, it would work for maths. Is how it would work for other subjects is the difficulty, isn't it? It's like what you would need to design from an ed tech perspective would be pretty vast, wouldn't it, to be able to meet that, I guess. And I guess, you know, there's loads of questions around it, isn't there? The feasibility, you know, how it would work. And I mean, if we can't get the latest iOS on working for the MTC check, you know, I'm just thinking of like how schools manage, you know, I totally see what you're saying. Like, it makes complete sense, isn't it? Because like, yes, it, like you say, you're not, it's not this hard line in the sand stuff bracket, you know, you've got to be fit inside. Yeah, it's silly, isn't it, really, when you're looking at it. That's really interesting, really, really interesting. I will listen to that at some point. That's been on my list to get to it. Some
nice. I mean, I have thought about the process, not willing to share it at this point for obvious financial reasons, but maybe in the future in a thinly disguised advertised podcast coming to your screens in the near future. Not money messing. It would be a really interesting one, and one I think we should pick up another time. Thank you for so much, guys, for giving me such a substantial amount of your summer evening. I really appreciate it. All I have to do is say thank you very much. Thank you very much, Lloyd.
Very welcome.
Thank you, Neil.
No problem at all.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.